Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. The producers, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking about the abuse of prescription drugs. It appears to be a growing public health problem here in the United States. It is estimated that tens of millions of people have used prescription drugs for non-medical reasons. It is, however, a complicated thing to talk about and to try to understand. We will do that this morning in this part of Focus 580, talk about some of the most commonly abused medications and try to look at some of the factors driving the misuse of legal drugs, prescription drugs. And our guest for the program is Carol Boyd. She is professor of nursing and women's studies at the University of Michigan School of Nursing. She's also director of the Institute for Research on Women and Gender and a research scientist at the Substance Abuse Research Center. She's interested in a number of things, including gender and substance abuse, alcohol and drug abuse among secondary and college students, and also prescription abuse. She's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome from people who are listening. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That is good anywhere that you can hear us. If it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. So at any point here in the conversation, you can call in with your question. The only thing that we ask of callers is just that people try to keep their questions brief, questions, comments brief, just so we can keep moving along. But anyone's welcome to call again, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor Boyd, hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it. One of the things that I was looking at here are some figures that came from the National Institute on Drug Abuse, from a report on this particular problem. And the numbers that they have in here are really quite significant. Their estimates were something like 48 million people, and that's like 20%, almost 20% of the population, have done what we're talking about, that is, use prescription drugs for non-medical reasons. And we'll talk in a minute about why it is. Maybe it's difficult to get a handle on what it is we're talking about. But just in terms of the numbers, do you think that that is actually a reasonable kind of number, 48 million?
I think it's reasonable. One thing to keep in mind is that that figure does not necessarily mean people who are using right at the moment or in the last 30 days. But nonetheless, it does reflect what is a growing problem in this country, and that is millions of people are using opioid stimulants, sedatives, tranquilizers, non-medically. And in fact, just to put this in perspective, if you compare the group of non-medical users of those prescription drug classes I spoke of, they are greater than the number of people in this country that use cocaine, crack, ecstasy, LSD, and heroin combined.
Okay, so it's a much bigger problem than the kind of illegal, illicit drug use that we think about when you use a term like drug abuse. So I guess that what that gets at, and it's sort of my understanding that people who are in the public health field have a little bit difficult time talking about this because they're not exactly sure what to call it.
Exactly. And you hear all of us use different terms. Some call it prescription drug abuse. In my own work, I call it prescription medication abuse, and I do that specifically, not to minimize it, but to reflect the fact that these are medications that have efficacy and are important tools for physicians and nurses and dentists and on and on. Nonetheless, they are being abused. They're highly addictive, and they cause problems, and people become addicted to them.
And just, again, to get a handle on what we're talking about, I guess maybe one reason why this is a little bit difficult to talk about, or maybe it's different than illicit drug use, is that while I'm sure that there are some people who are using prescription drugs for what we might consider to be recreational use, it seems that in many cases what people are doing is that they're actually using these for their intended, in a sense, for their intended use. That is, it may be people who feel that they are having an issue with depression, and so they've somehow managed to get their hands on an antidepressant, or maybe they are indeed having pain or think that they're having pain or that whatever. That is, they're hoping to get the effect that the drug is intended to produce It's just that they're not doing this under the direction of a physician.
That's true. But there are two issues here, and one piece that I think we should start by clarifying is that the drugs that we typically talk about when we're talking about prescription drug abuse are not the antidepressants, actually. Hmm. They come into four drug classes that are scheduled either by the FDA as a Schedule 2 or a Schedule 3 or a Schedule 4. Mm-hmm. And the reason they're scheduled in that way is because they have abuse liability, and they can, if used improperly, lead to what we consider addiction. So that's the one piece of that. So when I'm talking about prescription drug use, I'm talking about four drug classes. Now, in terms of the subtypes, that is those folks that self-treat as opposed to sensation seek, mm-hmm. I think you're absolutely right. That disproportionately, when we interview people who are engaged in non-medical use, we find that many of them view themselves as self-treating a condition for which the medication actually is intended. For instance, there may be a 18-year-old who had their wisdom teeth extracted and got Vicodin, isn't using the Vicodin anymore, has 10 pills left, has a friend who has a migraine, and gives the Vicodin to the friend for the migraine. So that the Vicodin will treat the migraine because it's an analgesic, but of course it's illegal what that teen just did. And it's a slippery slope and can be very risky. But it is true that most people, it appears, are engaging in self-treatment.
Yeah. See, that I think is interesting for a variety of reasons. But again, sort of to underline this, it seems that it's not so much that, in fact, it may happen. You know, people may just take them just to see what happens, or because that they get a desired effect that they think is positive and pleasant, and so that's why they're taking it. It seems that there is a pretty hefty component here of people who feel that they have some kind of a problem that needs treatment and would benefit from these medications. And they are indeed taking them because they have pain or because they have some kind of a problem that they feel need to be treated. Or maybe it is that in the case of, say, some people taking medications for a hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, things like Ritalin, they're not taking it just because it's fun to take it. They're taking it because they think that there's going to be a desired effect and that's going to be positive for them at some particular time.
Right. I think you're right. And that is why it's a complicated problem, because it's twofold. One is, why do people in this country not have access to the kind of care and the medications that they may need? That's one question. So it's possible that, for instance, using your Ritalin example, it is possible that there are youth who have been not diagnosed properly and benefit from the Ritalin that their friend gives them in terms of performance, but they themselves don't have access to a physician. They don't have health insurance or whatever it might be, and that is somewhat of a different issue, but of course it's related to this, and that is, are people getting the care they need? If they're not getting the care they need, is it that they are seeking out these addictive medications to self-treat, and then what are the risk factors with that? Because there are many risk factors with self-treating with these medications.
Yeah. I suppose the big one would indeed be you would develop dependence.
Well, that's the big one. And there's a gender difference in that development of dependence. Women tend to develop it more quickly than men, just as an aside. But some of the complications, it depends on the drug class. But when you're self-treating, you don't get the handout, for instance, the flyer that the pharmacist gives you, so you don't really know what you can mix with those medications, what the dosing of the medications is. Vicodin should never be taken with alcohol, for instance. It's got acetaminophen in it. All of those kinds of instructions, the person who is self-treating doesn't have access to.
So that suggests that in addition to the possibility of dependence, the other dangers here are that there are side effects and people might not be aware of them, or certainly they can produce side effects. And then there's the issue of drug interactions, which is the kind of thing that if you get a prescription, you certainly should be warned about. And that in this particular, and in a case like this, the person may simply not be aware of the potential dangers of mixing medications. And certainly we have seen it happen that people have overdosed, and it's been a little time, but I guess, you know, one of the things that people will think about is the case of Heath Ledger,
right, exactly.
the actor who died as a result of apparently taking a combination of, I think, mostly things that were legal drugs, that were prescription medications, but that simply should not have been all mixed up together, and that's what happened.
That's right. And as worried as I am about someone developing abuse and dependence diagnoses from using these non-medically, the greater risk for most 12 to 25-year-olds is the mixing of these medications, either mixing them together, that is, they take a benzodiazepine, such as Ativan or Xanax, or Valium, and they mix it with an opioid like Vicodin or OxyContin, or they use an amphetamine like Adderall or Ritalin, and they use it to drink more, and so they are confused about how much they've drank. And all of those are problem behaviors, and we should be worried about them.
I wonder whether also we have an issue here that people are making the assumption that because these are prescription medicines, that they have been approved and that doctors do write prescriptions for them, and a lot of people take them, that because they are prescription medications that they're safe.
Well, they are safe. That's why it's a complex problem, because the medications, if taken properly, are safe, generally. So, in that sense, if a person is sitting here in front of me and they have the choice between a Vicodin pill that comes from a pharmacy in the United States or a pack of heroin they're going to shoot, the Vicodin is absolutely safer. Mm. There's no question about that. But the point is, neither are safe. And the Vicodin taken for sensation-seeking purposes is correlated very highly with all kinds of other problem behaviors, particularly in adolescents and young adults.
Yeah.
And that's why I believe NIDA is concerned about this, researchers such as myself are, because 1 out of 10 adolescents are engaged in this behavior, and that's very high. And they go on, we don't know to do what, but many will develop additional problems related to it.
Yeah, and I want to say, by the way, I wasn't in the way I asked the question or posed the question, I wasn't meaning to suggest that these medications, when taken as directed under the direction of a physician, weren't safe. I guess I'm getting at the idea that people maybe aren't going to be as aware as they should be about the possibility of side effects and the issues of drug interactions, and they might think, well, these are prescription medications. There's no, you know, I don't need to worry as much about that as I might be as if I, you know, went down on the corner and bought something from a person there where it was clearly an illicit drug.
Yeah, and you're right. I appreciate that. I think that's true.
Yeah. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. In this hour of Focus 580, we're talking about the issue of the abuse of prescription drugs. And our guest for the program is Carol Boyd. She is professor of nursing and women's studies at the University of Michigan School of Nursing. This is one of the things that she's particularly interested in. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free 800-222-9455. And we do have someone to bring into the conversation in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Good morning. Interesting
yes.
program. I have one rationale for using something that was not prescribed for one, and that is my friend had surgery, and she talked with the doctor before, and then when she went in for a checkup and said, I'm still feeling so much pain, I would like to have whatever she asked for. That would be a prescribed pain medication. And he said, oh, no, you don't need anything that strong. He said, just buy something over the counter. So she did, but she had such pain, and her husband had some pills that he didn't use all of, and so he said, we'll take these, and they controlled the pain. And so in this case, it's a non-responsive physician who doesn't listen to the patient, and the patient does the easiest thing, which is to take something she knew, and she knew what the problems could be with it. She was informed, But clearly she didn't want to have to convince the doctor that she needed something that she knew she needed from the get-go. So there's a rationale.
I have heard many stories like this, and it highlights what a complex problem this is, because your friend technically was engaged in illegal behavior, and yet there is no way that the DEA would ever, or the police, or anyone would charge her with, in this particular case, where a husband has a leftover prescription and is helping his wife.
Right.
And I understand that. On the other hand, the physician that denies a patient medication that they believe they need, particularly pain medication, is doing so for several reasons. One is that they, and I'm not justifying it, I'm just simply, having worked with them, understand that. One is that they are afraid that abuse or dependence is occurring or has occurred, and so they try to, instead of having the time to talk to the patient about the pain and how much they were taking and whether they were taking too much, they just cut off the pain medication. And what we find in our own research is it leads to exactly what you're talking about, and that is, if you cut somebody's supply off from pain medication, they will find alternative sources of getting it. And far better that they work with a pain physician or someone who is specialized in treating the pain, who can work with them around the scheduling of the pain medication. Perhaps they can reduce the pain medications more slowly by adding some ibuprofen or something else.
Well, what you're describing would be a doctor who did not know my friend, because she is extremely cautious about what she takes, and she looks into things. She is a very scientifically oriented and professionally trained person, and the idea that she would in any way abuse a medication is absolutely impossible. What this patient did, my friend, she did what the doctor wouldn't do, which was meet her needs.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
She was in great pain, and having brought it up twice, before and after,
She
did not see any opportunity to get any success. And so I uphold what she did, which I guess was illegal, but I think we have a right to be an advocate for ourselves.
Your statement really does highlight how complex this issue is, because most people will keep, and I'm going to go right on record on the air saying that I also do. I had surgery, I had some medications left over, and I keep them. And I keep them for, hopefully I don't fall and break my leg, but if I do and I need them,
yes,
then I keep them around.
Right.
And what we found is that we were hoping, public health officials were hoping that they could talk people into disposing of their scheduled medication, mm-hmm, so that they weren't hanging around the house. So
right. Well, I've read that. You know.
Right. Of course.
Either take it all, whatever it is, whatever the doctor says, or get rid of it. But in this case, that would not have been helpful to my friend.
And we find that Americans are not willing to do that. They simply
paid for it. Why not have it?
That's how they feel. And so, but now the question is, how do you control and count it then? If you're going to keep your prescription medications for these scheduled medications that have abuse potential, then everybody who's listening should count their pills and control them. That means they put them somewhere where someone else cannot pilfer through them and pick them up and take them, and they should know how many are in the bottle. So that, because the real worry is the adolescents or the repair people or the cleaning people who come into your home. If they're sitting in your cupboard, they can just take them, and that is a worry.
Well, I guess my reaction to that is one has to know the people in one's home. My husband and I live in a home. He would no more take something that he shouldn't take or that somebody else was prescribed to take than a man in the moon. And if I had a cleaning person who was going to go through my shelves or drawers and take a medication, she would immediately be axed, because I wouldn't have anybody. In fact, I just had a conversation with a very good friend, and we were talking about her getting a cleaning person. And I said, the first thing is honesty. And I said, I will not abide anybody in my home whom I have to survey in order to know that they're not taking anything. And I said, that is the first thing. So if I can't pick out someone who is not going to steal pills from me, then I will take that responsibility. I'm not a very good judge of character. And there's nobody else in this house who comes in who would ever do that. Now you can say, well, we might think that, but, and in certain situations, you're absolutely right. But there are no teenagers, there are no children, there are no wayward people who are coming into this house, period. So that's my rebuttal to that.
And for people such as yourself, that makes sense. But there are many of us who have adolescent, including myself, who have adolescent children, and I'm a working mother, and I am not home all the time. And so for people in your situation, it makes sense that you don't have to worry about how they are controlled. But for many, many people, they do have to worry about how they're controlled, particularly parents whose children are using Ritalin and Adderall. Most children who are, well, most, 25% of children that are prescribed Adderall or Ritalin or an amphetamine for ADHD will be approached within the year to sell or to give away their medication. 25%. So, again, that's not having it in your house, such as the way you are speaking about it, but it is parents being able to knowing how many pills are in the bottle and knowing who has access to the bottle.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, I want to thank the caller. We're almost at our midpoint here in this part of Focus 580. We're talking about the abuse of prescription medications. Our guest is Carol Boyd. She is professor in the School of Nursing at the University of Michigan, where she's also director of the Institute for Research on Women and Gender and a research scientist in the Substance Abuse Research Center. And she's interested in a number of things. And as I said at the beginning of the program, such things as gender and substance abuse, alcohol and drug abuse among secondary and college students, and also prescription abuse and diversion. And questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, I guess I'm still wondering, you know, to what extent part of this, I think overall, I guess, we haven't, the question here is access, or maybe the issue is access, too easy access to controlled medications. I guess I'm still thinking about to what extent this is people, perhaps with the best of intentions, I guess, with honorable intentions, trying to help out a friend who says, you know, I've just had some dental work, I'm in terrible pain, and they say, oh, okay, I've got some pills, take this. Or someone who says, look, I'm having terrible trouble sleeping, and someone says, oh, I got something for that, take this. Or maybe if we're talking about college students, we have someone who says, look, I have a huge exams coming up, I really need to be focused, I really need to study, and somebody again says, oh, I got a pill for that, here, take one of these. How much of it is that kind of thing?
We're not sure yet, and the studies are being done right now. One of the problems with our national studies, such as the one that you cited right at the beginning of the program, is that the questions that were asked to get at this problem didn't allow the researchers to look at the number of people who were engaged in the following: those that had their own prescription, put it away, and then used it for some other reason. So that would be self-treating, not with a doctor's order, but your own medication. And or those people that divert their own pill to a family member or a friend specifically to help them. That is, they're not giving them the whole bottle to get high, but they are giving them one or two pills in order to get them through a problem. And we don't know the answer to that. We do know from my own work and my own NIDA-funded studies that when we look at 12 to 17-year-olds, that about 60% of those kids that engage in non-medical use actually do it for self-treatment purposes, exactly what you described.
Again, tell me what the...
About 60%.
About 60%. Mm-hmm. So it's not that little over half, they're actually doing the same thing the adults are doing, in sense that this is not purely recreational, it's not they're taking it because for fun, they're taking because they think they have some particular problem, and they know, okay, here's a thing that's supposed to treat that, and maybe I could go to the doctor and get this, but there's an easier way for me to do that if I know somebody who has it.
That's right. And again, it gets to what your first caller was speaking about, and that is people who don't have access to the medication that they perceive they need will find it. And they can find it in this country because there is an abundance of it. And the question is, to what extent is this abuse and dependence problem, or is it a medical problem and about accessibility for both treatment and then having too many pills sort of circulating in the market? So it's accessibility, whether you can get treatment, but it's also do we have too much treatment? You know, it's kind of a balance here.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller calling from New York, apparently, on our toll-free line four. Hello.
Hello there.
Yes.
Yes, I love the program. It's very, very interesting, thought-provoking program. And thank you for taking my call. I would just like to speak about an incident that I just recently went through with a friend of mine. I guess basically it illustrates the depth of the insurance situation and also how prescription drugs may actually be illegally taken. A friend of mine recently lost his job, and of course, with the job went the insurance, and he needed a very expensive inhaler for asthma. And I personally take this same inhaler. So basically, he was asking everyone that he knew, could he buy or get an inhaler like the one that he used just to maintain his asthma. And my heart went out to the guy. I couldn't afford to give up the one that I'm currently using, and couldn't exactly figure out how to get another one. As you know, you only get so many in a monthly period. And if I had one, I definitely would have given it to him. I know what it's like. And I understand that your guest saying that it illustrates a huge problem. It's so multifaceted, and it's so complicated. But I mean, sometimes the illegal route seems like the only one for certain people. And if you could comment on that, I'd appreciate it. And I'll hang up. Thank
All
you.
Right.
Bye.
Thank you for the call.
This is such a sad story, and increasingly we're hearing these stories. And I have nothing to say other than we badly need healthcare reform in this country so that people such as your friend do not need to seek out alternative ways of getting a hold of a prescription medication. And it does speak to an increasing problem in this country and, again, gets at this self-treater versus recreational user.
You know, one of the things that I'm interested in having you talk about, and again, it also gets at another aspect, I guess, of this access sort of issue. I recall not very long ago to being at a coffee shop that I frequent and just sort of sitting there and having my coffee and overhearing a conversation, some people who were sitting next to me. And I was really stunned what I was hearing. I was hearing this conversation about these people talking about all these medicines that they had tried and saying that, oh, yeah, I took this and I thought that and I tried this. And then one of the things that I heard them talking about was having gone on the internet to get medication, even though that they didn't have prescriptions for these medicines. And I'm thinking, well, what's going on here that you could just go on the internet? You know, if maybe one day you just decided you needed something or you wanted to try something to see what the effect was going to be. I'm not necessarily sure that these were people that were doing this recreationally necessarily, but it seemed almost like it was just they were trying something for the sake of trying it to see what the effect would be or if it would have a positive effect. And I'm thinking, well, can you go onto the internet and just get anything without having a prescription? And apparently the answer is yes, you can, and that's part of the problem.
Well, it is and it isn't. About 1% of non-medical users of scheduled medications get them through the internet. And it's pretty hard to get Schedule 2 medications over the internet. You can get Schedule 4. Schedule 4 are like the benzodiazepines. Mm. Now, this is where this gets even more complicated. You're talking about medications such as antidepressants and asthma, and your guest was talking about asthma inhalers. Right. Those are not scheduled. Those do not have abuse liability. What NIDA is concerned about and what I'm concerned about is the scheduled medications. And those are the tranquilizers, the opioid analgesics, the stimulants for ADHD, and the sleep medications like Lunesta and Ambien. Mm-hmm. And those are the ones that are more difficult to get on the internet, and are probably not what those folks were talking about. Now, if they were talking about those, they there was something that you said in this story that also raised a red flag for me, and that is that they were sampling them. And what we know about adolescents and young adults is that as soon as a person acknowledges that they try many different pills just to see how they feel, they are at great risk for abuse of prescription medications because they go out of that self-treatment category.
Mm-hmm. Well, it may, in fact, have been the case. You know, this was some time ago, and I was not trying to obviously be eavesdropping. That in fact, what they were doing was that they were indeed. In a sense, what they were doing was, as we have talked about before, is in whatever the medication we're talking about, they were self-prescribing.
Yes, they were.
That they were thinking, okay, I have X problem, and here's this medication that is for treating that, so maybe I'll see if I can get some of that and take it and see if it helps with X problem. But again, I guess that makes me think that maybe the kind of issue that we're talking about here, non-medical use of prescription medications, is even bigger than the idea of certain kinds of things that are really hazardous, that have addictive potential, that maybe people are also self-diagnosing and self-treating with a lot of other things as well that maybe aren't quite as problematic, but you might still want to say, well, I really think it would be a better idea that you consulted with a physician first before deciding that you had a particular condition and that a particular medication would be good for helping with that particular condition.
Indeed. But really, we shouldn't be surprised by this because we are one of the very few Western countries that have direct-to-consumer marketing of scheduled medications and other medications that are prescription. So it shouldn't surprise us that the public feels that they can self-prescribe or self-treat themselves because they can watch a commercial and they're told what their symptoms are and what medication will work for them. And I hazard to bet that part of our problem in this country is that we have allowed direct consumer marketing of prescription medications. And it has created a culture of medication takers and people who believe that they know what's best for themselves.
Well, let's talk with some other folks in Champaign next, line one. Hello.
Hi, I just had a comment. My doctor retired. I just wanted to tell your guest that over the years, before he retired, he was prescribing me dextamphetamine, which is a Schedule II drug, Xanax. I got myself all the way up to 12 milligrams. I was taking 5 Vicodin ES a day, which is 7.5, and 1.5 Dalmains. 30 milligrams and the half was 15 milligrams. Anyway, I got off all that medication, and now I'm just taking diazepam. But the point is these doctors now, for the people who really need pain medication, are scared to death to prescribe it to people who really need it. And I just wanted to make that comment. I'm going to hang up and listen.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think your caller raises a good point about physicians being afraid to prescribe Schedule II medications, particularly the opioid analgesics, because they worry that their patients may develop abuse or dependence and or that those pills may be diverted to another family member. The answer, though, in my opinion, is not to cut off the supply of pain medication to people, but rather to spend the time, and many, many physicians do, to spend the time to work with the patient to keep the patient stable with their pain and under control, but also to make sure that the patient isn't diverting their medications and or abusing them themselves. And there are many physicians in this country who specialize now in exactly this, and that is they are pain physicians who work with their patients. They drug test them. They count pills with their patients to make sure that patients are using these very strong medications as prescribed. But that's what's needed, because I also worry. I have a chronic health problem. I have had to have pain medications, and I worry about people who get their supply cut off because it really can affect the quality of their life.
All right. Thank the caller. Let's talk next with someone in Urbana, in line number two. Hello.
Yes, hello. Could you re-underline the necessity of not mixing alcohol and Vicodin, or for that matter, alcohol and acetaminophen, one, and then number two, the incidence of doctors themselves over medicating is just terrible, and that's demonstrated by the fact that they, of all the professions, they have the lowest lifespan. You might want to address that, or you might not. But thank you for taking my call. Bye.
Wow, this caller made some great points. So about acetaminophen and alcohol, if you look at the bottle of an acetaminophen tablets that you get in the pharmacy, and the trade names are, one of them is Tylenol, that's probably the best known, you will note on the back that there is a warning about consuming alcohol daily and using acetaminophen, and it's because it increases your risk of liver damage. So if you are a drinker, you should not be taking acetaminophen. So that's one point, and the caller is right about that. If you're drinking alcohol, you shouldn't be taking any medications that are CNS depressants because they increase your risk of depressing your respiratory system and having problems. And many, unfortunately, college students have died, and not just college students, but we know about college students mixing benzodiazepines or opioid analgesics with alcohol. So your caller is also really right about that. And then about physicians, and particularly anesthesiologists, as well as pain doctors and nurses and pharmacists and dentists, all of these professions have very high rates of substance abuse, higher than the average person in the population, or higher than the population. And physicians are at the greatest risk because they have a DEA license and they can prescribe these medications. So your caller is also right on when he notes that physicians are at such high risk for the non-medical use of scheduled prescription medications.
And I think it's good to remind people, I don't want to be too preachy, but remind people that they should be very careful when taking prescription medicines about what they're taking, about other things that they're taking in addition. I think the standard recommendation has been if you can get your prescriptions all filled at the same place, that's a good idea, because then somebody will know everything that you're taking. And if they give you a piece of paper that talks about things like how to take it, possible side effects, drug interactions, all that kind of stuff, read that and pay attention to that. And if you have any questions, don't hesitate to ask the pharmacist about it, just to make sure that you're taking things safely and in the way that they're intended.
That's great advice. That's terrific advice.
I think from time to time the focus is on particular age groups. You know, say we've talked a little bit about the problem of adolescents sharing pills, and occasionally we also find out about say college age students or people in that age bracket. But this is something a concern that extends all the way along, and that in particular one of the areas of concern, and we really haven't touched on it, I don't know how much attention it gets, but one area of concern is in fact seniors, older folks, in part because they as compared to the rest of the population, they're taking many more medications than younger people do. It's more likely that someone in the older age brackets will be taking more than one. And that for that reason, and sometimes it gets confusing enough keeping track of what you're supposed to take and how you're supposed to take it. But if you have a lot of different pills that you're juggling, it can, I guess, can be a more serious kind of issue.
It can be a very serious issue. And you raise an excellent point, because we do not have good data on the elderly and this problem, non-medical use of scheduled prescription medications. We anecdotally know that it's a problem. We know that, again, through case studies and smaller studies, that the elderly are prescribed many medications. They often get confused about how to take them, but they also see many doctors. And when you see many physicians and you're not going to the same pharmacy, one physician may not know what the other physician has prescribed. So that's a huge problem in and of itself, but that, of course, doesn't get at the issue of non-medical use. Mm-hmm. We do know anecdotally, and the few studies that have been done of the elderly show that there is pill swapping among the elderly, and it is much like what your first caller was talking about, and that is someone who doesn't have good pain control, but their neighbor has some extra Vicodin and is able to give it to them, or someone else who is a little confused but having trouble sleeping, so their friend gives them a sedative. And what happens is that that friend does not know about all the other medications that the elder has. There is also pill selling by the elderly, and the sad piece of this is that they don't have enough money to live on, and so they get their prescriptions and then they sell them. And there is quite a bit of evidence showing that this is also happening, particularly among those elderly that are living right on the edge of poverty.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, and I would like to reintroduce the guest. Carol Boyd is a professor of nursing and women's studies at the University of Michigan School of Nursing. She's director of the Institute for Research on Women and Gender, research scientist at the Substance Abuse Research Center, and is interested in the kind of things that we're talking about here this morning, about alcohol drug abuse among secondary and college students, about prescription abuse and diversion. Questions certainly welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Just again, I know we're kind of bouncing around here a little bit, but maybe just to return and underscore something that you said earlier that particularly has to do with adolescents and their non-medical use of prescription medications. And I think there always has been concern about how patterns of substance abuse develop over people's lives. Is there reason to believe that if we have adolescents that are doing this, that might develop into a kind of a lifelong dependency issue, either with these drugs or maybe with other things?
Well, we're very worried about that. But there are a couple pieces that we think we know at this moment that are reassuring. One is that when adolescents are prescribed scheduled medications and take them as prescribed, they appear at no greater risk for developing abuse and dependence problems in later life. So that's the good news for all you parents out there who have children that are prescribed, for instance, stimulants. Another piece is that we know that about 40% of adolescents who engage in this behavior, 40% only have used a prescription medication. They have not used any other illegal drug. So they haven't used marijuana, they haven't used alcohol underage, they have just used that prescription medication. Now, that's interesting because it fits with this idea that maybe this is a group of self-treaters, not sensation seekers. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, 60% have used other illicit drugs. So the worry here is for adolescents is that as they begin these risky behaviors, the 60% who are using other drugs, we can look at them, they tend to have other problem behaviors. They tend to gamble more. They tend to have sex earlier. And as I said, they use alcohol and other drugs. So in answer to your question, the good news is many adolescents, even those that engage in this behavior, with proper supervision and some good parental talking to, will turn out just fine and not get into problems. But there is a subgroup of sensation seekers that we're very worried about. We don't know how many there are. We know it's significant.
Right.
And I want to just add that there's a gender difference and that it appears that the girls are getting sicker quicker on these medications. That is, they're developing abuse and dependence at a higher likelihood than their male peers are. And by the way, that's true for all drugs. Women get sicker quicker from heroin, crack, ecstasy, but it now appears that this is true from prescription medication abuse.
And this has to do with physiological differences between the male body and the female body?
Oh, that's a great question. It probably, to some extent, it does. We believe at this time that it has to do with body weight and the size of the person. Mm-hmm. There's also, there may be a way that it's taken that puts a person at greater risk as well, and that is it taken to sensation seek? Is it to treat an underlying problem like sexual assault or incest, which then puts them at higher rates of abuse and dependence. So we're not sure about that, and my next study is going to look at exactly that question as to why this is happening.
Mm-hmm. We have another caller in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Thanks thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You were talking about the elderly, and it kind of reminded me of something. There's another form of abuse, prescription drug abuse, that I'd like you to speak about, and that is the off-label prescribing of drugs. I know that a lot of elderly with Alzheimer's have been prescribed antipsychotics, and in fact, a lot of even infants have been prescribed antipsychotics for which there's no justification on the label, and in fact, there's cautions on the label that you don't prescribe them to kids. Could you address that? Thanks.
Well, I'm not an expert on off-label prescribing. As a nurse, I've seen it done, and you're right, it happens probably more frequently than it should. I'm not sure what to say about it other than it is a problem, and physicians do engage in it. But the extent to which it happens, I really am not sure about.
Okay.
Sorry, I can't answer it better than that. But you are right that off-label prescribing can pose problems for the public.
I got you. Well, there's another one, too. You were talking about prescription drug use. I know there's something that they call kiddy cocaine, which was Ritalin, basically.
Right.
Which is another psychiatric drug which kids get and pass around. Apparently, they crush up these pills and snort them so that they get, instead of the time delay effect, they get the instant effect. Do you think that gives physicians pause in prescribing these drugs to children?
I think my experience in working with physicians who are ADHD specialists, it gives them great pause. And they are aware of the fact that both Adderall and Ritalin are crushed and snorted by particularly adolescents and college students. And our studies also show that there is a subgroup that crush them and snort them. As to bypassing any mechanism such as a controlled release or a timed release, Ritalin is not time-released, so they do get a boost, and they get a quick boost. They do call it kitty cocaine. That's also true. It works on the body like cocaine. It is an amphetamine. Ritalin is an amphetamine, as is Adderall, and it's a Schedule II medication along with OxyContin. So it's not the warnings are not trivial.
Right, right. And the fact that nobody's ever proven these things are caused by chemistry in the brain, ADHD and any of that, and that they're not even proven to be real illnesses or diseases and, in fact, are promoted, like you say, over-promoted by advertising directly to the public, I think has led to their proliferation, as has the use of antidepressants. Anyway, thanks for taking my call.
Sure. We're down to the point. We have a couple of minutes left, and you know, there are a couple of things that we've come back to again and again, and one is the issue of can people get seen by doctors when they need to and then get medicines if indeed they need them? That's a big issue which really has to do with healthcare in the United States. Not that that's a problem that we can particularly solve right here this morning. I guess, though, I'm thinking about there seems to me to be another component here, and it's a little bit more straightforward, or it seems a little bit more straightforward, and that is an educational kind of component where somehow we need to get people the message that potentially this is not a good thing, and that it's probably not a good thing to share your medications with other people, and, you know, that one ought to be careful about taking something that was not prescribed for you.
That's right. I think you're right. We cannot solve the fact that about 20% of people in this country do not feel they have adequate access to medical care. But 20% is high, and that may be a group that is engaging in non-medical use that we haven't tapped yet. Truly agree with you on the educational component. Part of the problem is that we have many of these pills floating around in backpacks, in medicine cabinets, in people's pockets and purses, and they are accessible to those that wish to sensation seek. Those that have the migraine that a friend passes the medication to, they aren't the ones that are rooting through somebody's medicine cabinet. So when the educational component really has to be aimed at controlling and counting pills so that the sensation seekers, those with the problem, don't have easy access to the medications. And it needs to be a real concerted effort by on the part of our government and public health service.
Well, at that, I think we'll have to leave it with our thanks to our guest, Carol Boyd. She's professor of nursing and women's studies at the University of Michigan School of Nursing, director of the Institute for Research on Women and Gender, research scientist with the Substance Abuse Research Center. And Professor Boyd, thank you very much.
Thank you.